Welcome. My name is Andrius Kulikauskas from Vilnius Gediminas Technical University. The original title for my talk was a question. Could the basis for language be the reduction of vagueness in order to coordinate activity? Having made some progress on this question, I will talk about my findings, and so accordingly I name my talk, Games as the Foundation for Universal Grammar. I preface my talk by thanking the organizers for inviting us to speak and for accommodating my talk, which will go for about 45 minutes because I will relate several topics. I'm also grateful to Daniel Milne-Flukebaum for starting a discussion about make-believe worlds. I start by noting the implausibility of traditional accounts of language as the transmission and construction of well-defined assemblies of well-defined terms. Instead, I consider our minds to be naturally vague, and I think of language as a means by which we reduce this vagueness for the sake of coordinating activity. I will propose that what makes us human is our ability to play games, that is, to create shared worlds which we enter and exit. I will show how every game is in principle the same, in that it potentially consists of 24 games. I will discuss how this universal framework is precisely what is needed for all manner of syntactic phenomena, and indeed for Noam Chomsky's universal grammar. I will present an alternative to what I think is an erroneous assumption made in linguistics as well as analytic philosophy, that language is well-defined. In particular, linguists assume that words are well-defined, which is to say we know what they mean. For example, Ronard Langacker, in his book, Cognitive Grammar, A Basic Introduction, talks about the cognitive domains which we appeal to in talking about a glass, such as the space it takes up, the shape it has, its function as a container, its function as a means for drinking. But the fact is that none of us truly knows what we or others mean by the word glass, and our lack of clarity would become obvious if the glass grew larger, so that some of us would claim that it is a glass, but others would argue that it is a container or a piece of furniture. Pragmatically, we don't need to know absolutely what we mean by glass, because typically we're not interested in the concept of a glass or even a particular glass, but what we really want is some water or simply to quench our thirst. My alternative is to recognize that our thinking is incredibly vague, and that our goal is simply to reduce that vagueness enough to coordinate our activity so that we might perform it satisfactorily. Thus, we can think of a glass as one of many things that we can pick up and set down, that we can wash, that we can drink from, and that we can serve to others, which is presumably why it is tall and transparent, so that we can see from afar if it needs to be refilled. We can fulfill a request to separate the glasses from the plates in the sink. And in doing so, we do not share a definition of what a glass is, but rather we each have our own quirky procedure for distinguishing a glass from other common objects. Indeed, the dictionary definition of a glass is nothing more than an institutional generalization of our personal rationalization of our unconscious neural capabilities. We actually don't truly know what we mean by glass, and that is the point of language, in that it allows us to make explicit what we unconsciously know and what we consciously don't know. I will present an account of how the central nervous system has evolved to allow for a dialogue between two kinds of thinking, what Kahneman calls System 1 and System 2, and what I will call what we unconsciously know and what we consciously don't know, which I claim are the basis for semantics and syntax, respectively. The evidence by which cognitive linguists such as Lakoff argue for the embodied mind can likewise be used to argue for a disembodied mind, which focuses ever more resources on what we don't know. A single-celled paramecium engages the world directly by way of its receptors for light and chemicals. But a butterfly lives in a world of flowers, that is, a neural representation of the world in terms of sensorial images which it pays attention to. As neuroscientist Michael Graziano has noted, a mouse furthermore has awareness in that it utilizes a model of attention which it can identify not only with its own attention, and thus be itself aware, but likewise model a cat's attention, and thus be aware of whether or not the cat is attending to the mouse. Thus the mouse lives an abstract world of indexical and causal relationships. But humans, and perhaps the great apes, can moreover be conscious, that is, We can choose what we wish to be aware of. We can focus on a symbol itself, or focus on what it might refer to. Humans, and probably apes, are able to divide up our global workspace into a few perspectives which define a particular issue. For example, matters of existence require two points of view. We need to be able to raise a question. Does a chair exist or not? But also suppose an answer. If it exists, then it exists. If not, then not. In linguistics, this is the fundamental distinction between construal and content. Similarly, questions of participation require three points of view, a cycle of taking a stand, following through, and reflecting. Such a cycle is the basis for the scientific method, having a hypothesis, conducting an experiment, and interpreting the results. In linguistics, this distinction between being, doing, and thinking is relevant in characterizing nouns, verbs, and evaluatives. Issues of knowledge require four points of view: whether, what, how, and why. We experience a cup as a sensory image, what, but also as a mental blueprint, how. We may furthermore imagine whether the cup is in a cupboard, even if nobody sees it. And when we imagine why there is a cup, then we suppose that we must know its relationships with absolutely everything. I've systematically cataloged such highly abstract cognitive frameworks which structure the options for our imagination. Decision-making requires five points of view, and morality six points of view. Finally, the seventh sum establishes the logical square which we need for a self-standing system, including the ability to divide and thus define opposites such as true and false or good and bad. The seventh sum is extremely important because it establishes the balancing act by which the questions of our conscious mind can be matched by the answers of our unconscious mind. Our unconscious mind is Kahneman's system one, the fast-thinking, associative mind, which always yields the one intuitive answer that summarizes the knowledge of 100 million neurons. System two is our slow-thinking, conscious mind, which comes up with questions that focus us on what we don't know and forces us to consider several points of view. We can imagine these as championed by the right, left. Although what matters is not the particular implementation, but that both mindsets are advocated with equal clarity. Cognitively, our conscious mind governs our unconscious mind, and emotionally, our unconscious mind provokes our conscious mind. The end result will be that we can match the semantics of what our unconscious mind knows with the syntax that structures what our conscious mind does not know. The logic of the seventh sum establishes a perfect duality whereby we can equally well think in terms of what is or what is not, what we know or what we don't know. An eighth perspective would include the possibility, all are true and all are false, in which case the system is empty, it collapses, and we have the null sum, the division of everything into no perspectives, like a blank page or an empty mind, by which we contemplate issues of God. I believe it is possible to model our experience of life in terms of eight highly abstract cognitive frameworks. We move from issue to issue by adding perspectives. Indeed, for consciousness, we add three perspectives. For to be conscious of a framework, we need to be able to step into it and step out of it and avail ourselves of both possibilities. Thus, when we become conscious of the issue of existence, then our state of mind is defined by the issue of decision-making. I have further documented the abstract structures by which we experience a perspective on a perspective. For example, the foursome, the framework for knowledge, has two representations which are important for the distinction between syntax and semantics. Idealists consider the observer's point perspective, their questions, what they don't know, and consider why most important and dismiss whether as irrelevant. Materialists think in terms of answers, the observed point of view, what is known, and so for them whether is most real and they would eliminate why. Ultimately, the two representations allow us to have syntactic variables and semantic instances. The threesome, the framework for participation, has four representations. Their 12 perspectives define the vocabulary of our imagination, the circumstances that we can attribute. We derive these 12 circumstances by playing mind games. For example, let us look for constancy. Either we find one example, or all is constantly unconstant. Furthermore, in searching for constancy, we assume that whatever we have selected and evaluated stays the same, and so they are multiply constant. With such a mind game, we define one, all, and many as primitives. I'm describing highly abstract cognitive building blocks. Some of them are frameworks, which divide our global workspace into perspectives. Others are perspectives on perspectives, either having us step out and consider all of our available perspectives, as with the representations, or having us step in, immersed in a particular perspective, as with the circumstances. Over the years, I've documented a system of 8 divisions, 6 representations, and 12 circumstances, which define an abstract world that our minds inhabit. In this tiny world, we have the freedom to adjust parameters, that is, to prefer certain values, attitudes, dispositions, options, perspectives, which then all the unconscious decisions, responses, and scripts that we follow in the world of symbols, indices, and icons which we are immersed in. Consciousness is our ability to choose whether to step in or to step out. In this sense, apes are likely conscious in much the same way that we are. In many ways, they seem to be as clever as we are. Michael Tomasello convincingly argues that what makes us human is our joint intentionality, our ability to come together as an ad hoc we, to conduct an activity on behalf of all, and then to share in the outcome. I will describe this intentionality as an expansion of the tiny abstract world which we inhabit in our minds. I claim that it arises when we conceive of a perspective on a perspective on a perspective. The middle perspective is a shared world, the make-believe world we're talking about, that we can improvise. We create and experience that shared world as a game which we enter and leave. We play the game by executing a grammar which expands the way we may align the semantics of what we know by stepping in with the syntax of what we don't know by stepping out. I'm researching 3 conceptual languages that this makes possible. Argumentation, by which issues come to matter, verbalization, by which words have meaning, and narration, by which events happen. In what follows, I focus on verbalization, the basis for natural language. Coco the gorilla makes use of about 1,000 signs and has even invented signs of her own, such as the ones pictured. Coco is able to string words together in intelligent ways. However, she does so without syntax. This syntaxless language is what Roy Jackendoff calls linear grammar. It is characteristic of the pidgin by which sailors communicate, the sign languages which deaf children invent to speak with their parents, the limited way in which some immigrants learn to speak the local language, and the diminished abilities of those who suffer certain kinds of brain damage. What does syntax add to language? I believe that it allows us to construct a system of perspectives which go beyond what we can focus on here and now. Syntax thus radically expands our ability to acknowledge what we don't understand, not just isolated words, but complicated thoughts which may make sense later or which may prove to be contradictory or simply nonsense. I will show how a universal grammar is presumed in playing games. But first, I will make our joint intentionality all the more vivid by suggesting a related physical characteristic by which we diverge from other apes. Human games are characterized by the creation of a shared world. Dutch historian Johan Huizinga called it the magic circle. His book, Homo Ludens, considers play the formative element of human culture. Well, many animals play, but truly Huizinga's ideas center on games. Physically, I believe that our games are facilitated by a bodily harmony, a synchronization of our unconscious movements, as if we were all dancing in slow motion. I've marked some examples of this harmony, which is sometimes called mirroring, but is actually much more complex in that our bodies unconsciously acknowledge all of the people around us, as we can surely see if we look around this room, and even the distribution of people around the room. There's something artistic about it, not random. Our bodies seek this harmony even when we compete against each other or when our thoughts are in different worlds. As Tomasello has noted, chimpanzees play different roles in a team, for example, in hunting a monkey. One chimpanzee may chase the monkey from above and another from below, but each of the chimpanzees is thinking, that is my monkey, and does not expect to share it should it capture the monkey. Chimpanzees are not loyal to the task at hand and can get distracted by something more enticing. As we see in this picture, each of these chimpanzees is in its own world. Note in this picture of chimpanzees together that they're not actually focused on the group, but on their one-to-one relationships within it. Gorillas do play tag, but I suspect it is a one-on-one activity. Whereas in this picture of Ethiopian singing, we see a wonderful harmony in how they naturally arrange themselves, even though their attention is scattered in different directions. Thus, I imagine that this human sixth sense may have co-evolved as the basis for our joint intentionality. Such a sense may have genetically arisen in identical twins, and their coordination may have been sexually attractive, fueling a virtuous cycle of evolution. Humans may have learned to establish and sustain joint intentionality through singing, drumming, and dancing in unison, perhaps while foraging, and perhaps to foster a shared mindset before a hunt and afterwards as well. Such activity could have driven the evolution of our vocal cords, our hands, and our posture. Autistic people seem to be lacking precisely this physical faculty. It is as if they are blind or deaf with regard to this sixth sense. Such a physical disability would make it hard for them to join with others in a shared world. Autistic people face the challenge of consciously learning the cues for joint intentionality which the rest of us master unconsciously. Come be with me, come play with me, come do what I do, are games to develop joint intentionality. Autism is in fact a spectrum, including Asperger's syndrome, which by this analogy suggests that some may lack this sixth sense to a degree, just as I myself am poor of sight. I will now present a wonderful source of anthropological data about games. I will use this data to propose a universal grammar for games and all human activity for creating meaning, including human language. Dave Gray, Suni Brown, and James Makanufo are consultants who wrote a book called Game Storming and have a related website. They have collected about 100 innovation games played in Silicon Valley to help corporate teams function creatively. Different games serve different purposes, and I became interested in how those purposes might come together as a framework for innovation, or more broadly, figuring things out. In my first attempt to diagram the purpose, I noted how they unfolded. We may start with games for consenting, for caring about each other and the issue, and for understanding the issue. The climax of innovation is when we distill the idea. For example, when we can draw it on the back of a napkin or explain it in an elevator pitch. Often this comes from inverting our point of view. For example, taking up the customer's point of view. After we gain this new perspective, there are games that help us innovate, validate, and commit ourselves. I then took a fresh look to consider what we focus on with these various innovation games. Some of them have us focus on the bigger picture, appealing to the real world. Others have us focus on our fellow participants, getting to know them, respecting them, and including them. There are games that have us focus on the games themselves, that is, the rules for the innovation process. And ultimately, there are games which have us focus on the deliverable, that creative output which is the goal of the creative process, and from the company's point of view, the product or service that it hopes to sell. Thus, we can think of the innovation framework as itself being a game, which first has us set up the preconditions for creativity, then has us create our deliverable, and finally has us return with that deliverable back into the real world. But this suggests, vice versa, that every game may potentially be considered as an innovation framework for games within that game. I saw that I could organize the games into 24 groups based on their purposes. The resulting structure is one that I had recognized earlier in studying the ways of figuring things out. First, there are games for initiating a game. There are also games which let us start a game within a game. There are games which identify the meaning of a game. There are three kinds of games for a learning cycle by which we clarify that meaning. There are four kinds of games for grounding that meaning in the real world on four different levels. There are six kinds of games which make sense of that meaning by making sure those four levels are distinct. There are four kinds of games for progressively entering into the game and honoring its purpose, and there are four kinds of games for progressively leaving the game and honoring its outcome. Thus, there are 24 games in all within every full-fledged game. I will start by talking about a quick innovation game, the pie chart agenda, which is used at the beginning of meetings. The participants agree on how to organize the agenda for a meeting by drawing it visually as a pie chart, which shows what items will be considered and proportionally how much time will be given to them. We can say this is a game for initiating a larger game, for gaining consent, but we can also think of it as calling out the name of a game and commanding it into being. A game can be initiated without words, simply showing up at a basketball court with a basketball ready to play. In linguistics, we can open our mouth to say a word, clear our throat before we start a sentence, or say an introductory phrase like, hello. At the heart of the innovation process are the games that distill the essence of the deliverable. Such games include Draw the Problem, where we illustrate a problem in a way that would make us care. In a basketball game, the essence might be the final score, but it might also be a defining moment. The goal of coming up with a deliverable induces the familiar grammatical distinction between subject, object, and verb. A participant is a subject, and their activity is a verb, but the deliverable is an object. This suggests that the object is the whole point of talking, and it shows the importance of the passive voice in that it converts the participant into the deliverable, which is to say, the participant becomes important, and we empathize with that. The claim is that me demands empathy, and I does not. In terms of the big picture, we enter a game with a question. We play the game, and then we leave the game with an answer. The question is the reason why we play the game, and the answer is what is the outcome of the game. In a basketball game, the question may be, who will win? And the answer is whoever won. Within the game, we focus on how to play. Of course, we could shoot baskets without keeping score and simply end our play when it's time to go home. So long as we create a shared world, a make-believe world, which we enter and then leave, we can call it a game. The question could be, how could we kill some time? And the answer could be, that was kind of fun. Every game set has three phases. In chess, they are called the opening, middle game, and end game. There are innovation games which start the creative process by asking questions. The question opens up our thinking and allows us to diverge. Then there follow games which explore various angles and seek for a new idea to emerge. Finally, there are games that have us converge upon an answer. In linguistics, we similarly distinguish between nouns, verbs, and evaluatives. The three phases accord with the learning cycle, putting an idea, trying it out, and evaluating it. Such a cycle leads to increasing clarity, and it can be repeated over and over again. We can return to the same question or consider a new question. We can string together different games if every one of them has a clear beginning and a clear end. In a similar way, we can concatenate sounds, syllables, words, clauses, or sentences. Once upon a time, I was wondering whether it made sense for me to finish my PhD studies. My mother advised me, you want to be a person who starts what he finishes. And this general principle is known as the house rule. If you open it, close it. If you turn it on, turn it off. In general, if you enter a game, then you should leave the game. You enter a game by asking a question, what you don't know, and you leave the game by accepting an answer, what you come to know. This is how we relate our conscious not knowing and our unconscious knowing. We establish a shared world, create meaning within it, and then bring it out with us. It makes sense to think of every sentence as a game. The question is given by the subject or topic. The answer is given by the predicate or comment. It is thus troubling to hear a subject without a predicate, unless that subject is the reply to a question, whereas a predicate can stand on its own with the subject implied. Similarly, every word is a game. A new word, Brno, makes me wonder, what is Brno? I need to learn from somebody, this is Brno. But the true meaning of Brno for me will be some personal impression that I distill, which is the point of that game. What makes the creative process very powerful is that there can be games within games. Or more precisely, there are games which make room for such games. For example, there can be a lunch break, which lets us relax and can inspire our creativity. In this way, there can be words within words, or sentences within sentences. We start to realize that everything is a game, subject to the same grammar. Our culture is the game of all games. There are innovation games which ground our meaning in the bigger picture. Body storming has us physically feel the implications of our ideas. History map has us appreciate and acknowledge our corporate culture as the basis for agreement. Plus Delta has us incrementally improve by acknowledging what is good and what could be better. Design the Box has us invert our perspective by considering the customer's point of view. These four games are dialectics, which help us distinguish the semantic truth and the syntactic truth. The semantic truth is the conditional truth of the game, which expresses what our unconscious mind knows. The syntactic truth is the unconditional truth beyond all games, which expresses what our conscious mind does not know. Both truths are true, but they pull us in different directions. We should focus on the syntactic truth, relevant truth, in terms of what we don't know. Syntax makes semantics relevant, but not the other way around. For example, there was a time when I felt riled in my encounters with the homeless. They would ask me for money, and I felt that I was in a game that was wrong. I believed that my help could make things worse. But then I realized that there was another truth, that if somebody asked for help or needed help, then I should help. I came up with four tests which distinguished the narrower semantic truth of the game from the bigger syntactic truth. The first test was that I was feeling riled, and so I was thinking wrong. I had confused the two truths. If I was thinking right, then I would feel calm. The second test is that the syntactic truth leads to the semantic truth, but not the other way around. If I try to help, then I won't want to make things worse. But if I focus on my help not making things worse, then I will never help anybody. The third test is that we can learn the semantic truth from example. I can describe how my help has made things worse. But the syntactic truth is tautological. We can't show it, and it must have always been inside of us. There's no way to show that we should help others. Finally, on any subject such as helping others, we can consider four questions: whether, what, how, and why. And the syntactic truth always asks the broader question. What help do we give? We don't make things worse. But why do we help? Because we should. I found these four tests to agree. We can think of them as looking at the game from within it and beyond it, entering it and leaving it. In basketball, this means that you should not cheat, but play fair. In linguistics, it means that different factors can redeem a sentence or make it unacceptable, including our greater or lesser processing power, the abundance or lack of relevant context, syntactic flexibility or violations, and inspiring or confusing stylistic emphases. There are six innovation games which are almost purely syntactic in that they focus on the game itself. They reorganize and visualize the components. Note that our unconscious mind is built from a network of associations, where the grammar of our game allows for sequences of games, horizontally, games after games, and trees of games, vertically, games within games. Thus, there are games which take a large structure, which our unconscious has mastered, a sequence, tree, or web, and restructure it with a smaller structure that our conscious is exploring. This yields six familiar visualizations, but also six paradoxes which highlight the gap between the structures. Thus, these games give us intuition by highlighting inherent paradox. Evolution. A hierarchy of variations is restructured with a sequence of times. The paradox is that concepts may be inexact. We can't specify exactly at what point in the womb a child becomes conscious, or at what point in evolution two species diverge. Atlas, a network of adjacency relations, is restructured with a hierarchy of global and local views. The paradox is that the whole is not the sum of the parts. If we replace all of the parts of an automobile and then build a copy with all of the old parts, which is the original? Handbook. A sequence of instructions is restructured with a net of branches. The paradox is that our attention affects what we observe. Achilles can never catch a tortoise if we keep measuring the distance between them. Chronicle. A sequence of events in time is restructured with a hierarchy of time periods. The paradox is that there may be a limited contradiction. How can we reliably learn from one who has ever made a mistake? Catalog. A hierarchy of concepts is restructured with a network of crosslinks. The paradox is that we cannot make explicit all relevant assumptions. What is 10 plus 4? It's 2, if we happen to be thinking about a clock. Tour. A network of states is restructured with a sequence of steps. The paradox is that we can choose differently in the same circumstances. I'm lying when I say I'm lying. What these games are doing is answering a question with a question, which is to say, extending syntactic obligations with more obligations. Linguistically, I think this could describe how we construct micro-obligations as we roll out our sentences. The fact is that when we start speaking a sentence, we may have no idea how it is going to end. This shows that the traditional syntactic views are absurdly false. Indeed, it seems clear that as we construct our thoughts, we variously commit ourselves and have to keep talking until we satisfy all of our commitments to ourselves and others. So, for example, if I say, I will have some, I can't continue with ball. We have to check our commitments. These commitments include tracking, case, tense, number, gender, using definite or indefinite articles, and measure words. It is curious that, in practice, there are no simple languages, so that Japanese seems to compensate for its regularity by using a dauntingly complicated set of honorifics. I suspect the reason is that these micro-obligations are precisely what allow us to unpack first the syntax and then the semantics of a complicated sentence as we keep track of what we are hearing. Answering a question with a question is a way of freeing ourselves from semantics. There are situations where we can't rely on anything we know. For example, how do I know that if I say whittlesticks, this building won't collapse tomorrow? Well, I reply with a counter question. What do I have control over? If the building is so curiously designed, can it truly be my fault? Indeed, there are 6 such counter questions which distinguish the 4 levels of knowledge and help us get by without any semantic knowledge. Finally, there are 4 games by which we enter into a game and 4 games by which we leave it. These are games that have us honor the purpose, why we are playing the game, and honor the outcome, what we got out of it. I think these 8 games straddle the 2 representations of the foursome, the questions that we consciously ask, and the answers which our unconscious provides. We enter a game asking a question, and we leave it with some answer. Semantically, in the big picture, it must all relate to other people. And the game represents a shift in our sense of agency. The innovation game, 5 whys, takes down the reason for why we're playing. The why upon why upon why upon why upon why. But then we have to likewise empathize with others, to respect them, and include them. And there are games for all of that. By the time that we leave the game, our focus has shifted to what we have achieved with others, to their dreams, their positions, and their self-definition. And this lets us appeal to a bigger audience, the broader society, or the corporate customer out there. What this means is that our sense of agency shifts. Syntactic thinking allows us to convert our internal sense of agency, in terms of agents, beneficiaries, and goals, into an external sense of agency, in terms of instruments, themes, and locations. But these are precisely the 6 levels of the Kiparsky gradation of thematic roles, and closely related to the case system underlying Indo-European languages. Thus, the case system appears to be conveying the most basic semantic distinctions. Such semantic distinctions may also be natural to memory. In studying spoken and written languages, it is amazing that the most irregular words or characters are typically among the most common. It is precisely the uncommon words which tend to have regularity. But this makes perfect sense as we think of memory as a set of compartments waiting to be filled. If we have an empty compartment, then we can remember from a single occurrence that something fits within it. And we seem to remember not what satisfies the compartment, but rather we recognize that we have a compartment that we didn't know about before. It doesn't really matter what fills the compartment until we start to lack room. Then, in order to squeeze things in, we have to discover regularity. This simple theory explains why it is easy to learn a first language, but why it is difficult to learn a second language if all of the relevant compartments are already filled. I first worked out this overall system in documenting and systematizing the ways of figuring things out, and he very nicely organized the techniques involved in solving mathematical problems. I think we'd get the same system if we looked at the ways of figuring things out in physics, medicine, business, or any other discipline, or those used by any particular individual. That's endlessly worthwhile to explore. Such a universal grammar for creating a shared world and, indeed, for figuring it out is precisely what is needed for children to learn language. A universal system means that they know the various ways they should try to find meaning and make meaning, to understand others and to be understood. I hope to have shown that innovation games are very helpful anthropological data because they invariably have a purpose, which lets us know where they might fit in a broader game. We can think of our entire culture as a game that we could engineer together. Indeed, we can think of our life as a game where we ask, what is the meaning of life? Or simply, why are we here? And our life ends, in one sense, when we know ourselves, our reason why we do what we should do, our deepest value, which includes all of our other values. But it begins anew as an eternally unfolding life in that we dare to live by asking questions, by focusing on what we don't know, but would like to discuss.
Thank you for the talk. And now it's time for your commentary or questions. Any questions?
Did anybody understand anything? No. Or was it understandable?
It was overwhelming.
I see. That's the mind I live in. It's just a small part. But,
I will have some question.
Good.
If I understand it correctly, you have created your own classification of the games.
Yes, it's my own.
What did you do? How do you proceed?
Well, so the idea was, I did this a couple of times, and I think basically, if I go back, I worked on my own philosophy independently for 35 years now, and, you know, no one could really maybe care about it. But I thought, what I should do is to document all the ways I figured things out. So I had like 200 investigations I wrote on that I've done. And then I thought, and I should systematize it, because obviously there must be, everything I do is, you know, some kind of cognitive framework. So, and I came up basically with this system, very similar. And then I did it for math differently. And I was interested in the game storming, which is right here. I was interested because I thought, well, those are ways of, database of 1,500 ways, you know, different ideas. And it was kind of hard to organize, but I realized the crucial thing to focus on was the purpose. To say, games may look very different, but if they have the same purpose, like, you know, if the purpose is to get consent, then it doesn't matter what they're doing. That's the category. And then if I looked at the purpose, I could say, well, there seems to be some order in these purposes. They seem to have a certain sequence, like you commit at the end, you get consent in the beginning, you know, then you have to get people to care, you have to understand, you have a climax where you transform, you innovate, you validate, you commit. So, and then some of these games are more explicit and some of them are more implicit. And so that's what I was going to talk about at a business conference on creativity a week ago. And I took a fresh look. So then I said, well, I think it should relate back to that master plan, you know. So I said, focus on who the game is about. And then I realized that, well, I get this kind of coloring, context, participants, game, deliverable, and that it keeps naturally shifting, you know. And that the drill of the game is about the deliverable, but you have to get there. You have to create the preconditions. So you go in and you come out. And then I realized I'm going to try to redo this. So I kind of redid it with that better, those better clues. And you can agree or not, but at least you can see in my mind it started to fall into place. And then when the beauty of these structures is that every single structure I've shown, you know, I have lots of evidence for in different domains. So this kind of just pulls me. But new things come. So this whole dialogue between syntax and semantics, you see, it started to creep in. That is these two languages, or like the condiments, system one and system two. So these are like recent things, or like the left brain and the right brain. Or there's this kind of balance. Or duality in logic. You know, why is logic so perfectly dual? With De Morgan's laws, you flip them over and it doesn't really matter if things are or they are. So a week ago, I was giving a talk and at 12 o'clock, I realized I can make this system work. And so I didn't get much sleep, but I did the presentation. And then I thought, oh, I can look at syntax now. You see, and so this typical thing I do. I went to Wikipedia. I'm going to look up all the syntactic phenomena. It turns out there's not that many. There's maybe like 40. And if you organize them, I almost covered them all. I mean, I didn't cover them all, but it would not. If you had an hour, you could probably go through them all. But the basic things, like you know, this is fanciful what I've talked about, but the subject, object, the verb, you know, or you know. So I've tried to go through, and then maybe the last thing, you get beautiful coincidences. So for example, you realize, oh, apes don't ask questions. Well, then it's obvious from this why they don't ask. They don't play games. The game, you have to, if you ask the question, you start a game. So that's, you know, that doesn't prove anything, but it's just, you collect these little things, a little collection. So.
Thank you.
Quite
fascinating.
Thank you.
Any other question or commentary? If not, I will. Thank you.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. We'll talk.